All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Thursday, July 9th, 2015. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Thursday. We're almost there. It is 66 degrees and overcast here in upstate New York. I see on the map, looks like there's a massive blob of rain heading my way, which would explain why I felt like staying in bed today. All right, where do we leave off yesterday? We titled the show Dopamine Brain Hijacking and the Dumbing of America. We had discussed how dopamine is the way to control people in regards to the dangling carrot. It is also the chemical that they have found is most prevalent in psychopathic brains, and how anything that makes you feel addicted, like gambling, sex, cigarettes, alcohol, I'm sure coffee could be included in there, helps your body produce more dopamine. And of course, these are the vices that we satiate ourselves with in 21st century America. One of the things I wanted to look at before we changed gears is this website called The Dopamine Project that I had stumbled upon a few days ago. And if this sucker loads, which something really weird is going on here. Hold on one second. It's trying to like send me to YouTube and here we go. All right, it's called The Dopamine Project. And they had a really good breakout of all of the issues that we see with dopamine addiction. And I wanted to kind of read this to you just so you understand. I mean, I know it sounds crazy, and I know that the addiction and the control and the dangling carrot, especially of our children, sounds like, you know, it's something that we can deal with. But just listen to this. It says dopamine addiction. Using brain scanning equipment, researchers have established that all addictions can be traced to dopamine-induced expectations. Expectations of scoring dopamine squirts in their brain keep addicts lying, cheating, stealing, and craving the next fix. And what's interesting about this is 2 days ago we had read a story in regards to the moral judgment that people have when they are on different antidepressants. And in the experiment, they had one antidepressant was a serotonin booster, and the other antidepressant was a dopamine booster. And that was the drug levodopa, I believe, that was used for treating Parkinson's. And what I didn't realize, too, in digging a little bit deeper, I guess, people with Parkinson's that are on treatment actually have a big problem with gambling, they've discovered. Well, this absolutely explains why. And in that experiment, if you remember, too, people that were treated with the levodopa, the dopamine boosting antidepressant, were more probable to be willing to hurt people for money. And remember, video games create the same sorts of reactions in the brain, the dopamine release and the requirement for more. Anyway, let's get back to this dopamine project. Expectations of scoring dopamine squirts in their brains keep addicts lying, cheating, stealing, and craving the next fix. And I mean, this is just like any addiction. They said yesterday, heroin, cocaine, nicotine. I mean, if you've ever been an addict on anything and been cut off from your supply and years later come out the other side and look back at yourself, you're like, holy shit, what a horrible asshole I was. Because I didn't give two shits who I hurt, because all you wanted to get was that next fix. I mean, they're turning our children into these types of individuals, utilizing our own body chemicals, which is frightening. Back to the story. For some, the expectations involve heroin. For others, it can be cocaine, nicotine, alcohol, sex, gambling, or food. And yes, we looked at one of the other things in the list that produces dopamine is sugary foods and high fructose corn syrup, as well as fatty foods like from your fast food hamburger places. Addictions to legal and illegal drugs are hard to deny because they involve ingesting, inhaling, or injecting obvious substances. Physical addictions destroy lives and wreak societal damage, but the most common and dangerous behaviors involve easily denied psychological addictions. Psychological addictions are more insidious because the dopamine is triggered by emotions, memories, thoughts, fantasies, ideologies, rhetoric, deceptions, and other intangibles. And one of the other things that we discovered in our research is that digital devices, your smartphone, the computer, the video games, also cause your brain to produce this dopamine release that then causes you to become addicted. And I talked about my own experiences with my child. I mean, I can see it. I can absolutely see it. And she's a really good kid, but I'll tell you what, when it comes to computer time, she will lie and sneak or do whatever it takes to be able to get up there and get back on the computer after I said, it's done. We're done. It's off. No more today. And it's very disturbing to me to see a change like that in a personality caused by something that we take for granted, such as our digital devices that are so prevalent everywhere. You know, and this leads to, and, you know, this is something we're going to get to a little bit later here, looking at DARPA and this whole merging with the machine. This is why this hijacking of our brain chemicals and people being addicted to the machine, let's say, and always being online, and the thrill you get when you get a new message, or when, you know, you play a new game or you kill a new criminal in your video game, that thrill is what is pushing this transhumanist merging with machine agenda forward. It's convincing people that, yes, you want your fix. And I mean, now you don't even have to have pesky passwords, or you don't have to have your device that you might drop in the water or lose. Let's just implant it in your head and augment your reality so it'll always be with you like your best friend. I mean, how sick is this? It's very sick to me. Anyway, back to the story. Decades ago, psychologist Abram Maslow identified and characterized what he called deficiency needs, or D needs for short. The D needs can be divided into physiological needs, such as air, water, salt, food, sex, and psychological needs for safety or power, acceptance, approval, attention, or esteem and status. It is only a question of time until dopamine-induced addictions are extended to all of Maslow's deficiency needs. And until then, the world's best-kept non-secret will continue to remain conveniently overlooked and ignored. Currently, safety, power, acceptance, approval, attention, esteem, and status addictions aren't considered addictions because we inherited our addictive behaviors, deceptions, and denials from our clever ancestors. As a result, we are all born and indoctrinated into a highly addictive society where ignoring psychological addictions is the norm. Yes, but we also found that a lot of those, the power, acceptance, approval, attention, esteem, and status, are all symptoms of narcissistic disorder that then can spin into a full-blown psychopathy. So how interesting is that? Moreover, the most driven power and esteem addicts are compelled by dopamine-induced expectations to control the institutions that define sanity, morality, and addictions. And that is the absolute truth. The more powerful the addiction, the greater the self-deception and denial. And anyone, like I said, who's been addicted to anything will deny that they are addicted. That's the first step to acceptance and quitting, isn't it? Is to accept that you're addicted. They have less free will, and more likely addicts are to ignore, dismiss, and detest information that threatens to expose their addictions and keeping them from trying to satisfy their insatiable cravings. To keep the dopamine flowing, heroin addicts shoot up, safety addicts follow, power addicts control, acceptance addicts flock, approval addicts acquiesce, and esteem addicts flaunt. And one important distinction between addiction is that heroin addicts are needless, whereas psychological addicts get away with pretending their addictions are normal, acceptable, and even admirable. So I don't know. And there are tons of articles here that go into all of the different studies of dopamine, you can actually take a look at this if you want, if you have any interest in this, because I think it's very important. Maybe we'll hop back here, but I know we've done already a few shows over the last 6 months or so about the dangling carrot and dopamine and how they use it to manipulate us. But this project is at dopamineproject.org/dopamine-addiction-DA. And I will post this in the notes of the show once the show is over for anyone who wants to get out there and has trouble and can't find it. So there you go. Dopamine addiction. I mean, it's been bred into us through our ancestors. And I do see that addiction, like alcoholism, let's say, is something that can be passed down through generations. But I also believe that, you know, even though they say that they find genes for these things, I think there is a personality disorder, and that is this psychopathy, this whole set of traits that come along with the psychopathy and the narcissistic disorder that make you more prone to needing more dopamine. They're the fast livers. They're the ones who like it fast and do it crazy and like to do all kinds of insane things, get off on the adrenaline boost and the dopamine boost because it floats their boat. And trust me, I have family members. So I 100% have experienced this. I've learned to put the brakes on things because I know it's not good for me. And I've seen what it's done to others in my family over the years. But, you know, if I let it go, I can step over to the other side. Thank goodness I can do it and then come back again. But there are some people that I know that get lost on the other side. And you don't want to do that because that is assured self-destruction and potentially early death. You don't want to be doing that. All right. So where do we go from here? There was another story that I saw that came out this morning from Collective Evolution. It was from today, as a matter of fact, July 9, 2015, what screen addiction is doing to your children. I was like, oh, this fits perfectly into exactly what we've been talking about. The world has changed incredibly quickly over the past few centuries, and we can be sure we'll continue to do so at an exponential rate. Yes, mad science gone mad. This has many people now questioning what we are doing here and in what direction our species is heading. And if you've listened to the show for any length of time, you will absolutely know the direction that we're heading. We are heading right into the jaws of evil, right into the jaws of mad science gone mad and human 2.0. And I don't know about you, but I personally like being human 1.0 with all of our foibles. You know, maybe we can get a little better at curing disease with natural remedies as opposed to nanotechnology and putting self-replicating nanobots into our bloodstream. And I would be happy with that. Let's not kill the planet. Let's try and be good custodians so we have something here for our children to see and enjoy. One of the other things, too, I wanted to talk about when a couple days ago when we were looking at that whole experiment with the antidepressants and chemical boosting and the moral lack of morals, let's say, when taking some of these drugs, and I had said, well, get a cat or go sniff a flower. You know, there were two more studies that I found right after that that show specifically that. I mean, I know it, I feel it. When I start to feel really down and like I can't even do this anymore, I just need to get away and go into the woods and go just be one with nature, turn off the computer, not pay attention to anything, and just enjoy the birds, the crickets, the fresh air, and the sunshine. And that fixes me very well. And yes, who would have thunk it? There's a couple big studies out there that said that being one with nature, communing with nature, is a big cure for depression. So don't take pills, people. Go take off your shoes and walk in the grass. Smell a flower, pet a cat. Watch a hopping little bunny. Little bunny babies are so cute. All right, back to the story about screen addiction in our children. So what are innovations like computers, the internet, cell phones, among others, doing to our children? Well, good question. Well, they could be doing a lot more than we think and little of it good. There is a widespread consensus in the scientific community that the radiation alone from these devices can be very debilitating to our health in the long term. And yes, I mean, they've been looking at not only cell phone radiation, but also Wi-Fi, which is ubiquitous everywhere now, and especially in schools where our kids spend a majority of their day during the school year, but also in our homes. Now they're putting free Wi-Fi into cities, libraries, coffee shops. I mean, it's everywhere. And there really hasn't been any long-term study as to what be our bodies being pummeled by all these different wavelengths 24/7. And don't forget, I mean, we've had television, we've had radio long before that. We had cordless cell phones, and those all work, you know, progressively. They have taken the wavelengths and made them higher and higher frequencies. And the higher the frequency, if you look at the electromagnetic spectrum, the higher the frequency, typically the more dangerous the radiation. So, you know, you can have radio waves versus, let's say, microwaves or X-rays. The more powerful waves that you have, the more damage that they do to cells. Back to the story, we are approaching a time where we will potentially begin to see the effects surface, given the fact that these first cell phone, computer, internet, video game generations is approaching the age of 30. And I'm going to argue with that a little bit, because I'd say maybe for the general public, trying to think back in 1995, so that was 20 years ago, 1995 is when we first started to see the internet become consumerly acceptable. You know, we had it before then. I was on those services. Prodigy was one of the very first ones, even before AOL. But I mean, I was a rarity in the time. It was because my dad loved toys, so we had one of the first computers. But there really wasn't prevalent internet. And I'm trying to think of my first cell phone too. I mean, maybe the age of 30, in that they were 10 or so by the time it came out, and then they got on it. So, okay, maybe we can go there. So let's say they're 30, but even 45. I mean, when you were, if you're 45 or a little bit beyond, you saw the beginning of all of this, and you were the first one to have a VCR and the first ones to have a microwave and the first ones to have cable. You know, all of that has come in our lifetime. All right, back to the story. Multiple studies have revealed that cell phone radiation can cause cancer. And yes, they should have put multiple studies from other countries besides the United States, because I haven't really seen any studies here in the United States that have proven that cell phones can cause cancer. I have known a few people who were sales reps for cell phone companies and who were on their cell phones 24/7 against their heads, who have ended up with those brain tumors that are right behind their cell phone ear. So in my mind, there really isn't any doubt, even if it was what's the word I'm looking for? I don't know. There's an ad playing here in the corner, so it keeps distracting me. I'm gonna put my hands up so I don't look at it. Even if my friend getting cancer behind her ear was a oh my god, what's the word I'm looking for? You know what I'm saying? If it was just that consequence, damn it. Well, even if it was just a freak that she ended up with the cancer behind her ear, don't think that putting that cell phone against your head, it, you know, back in the days when we used to do that, you could literally feel the numbness that came in your hand and in the side of your head by putting that sucker up there. I don't think that that's doing any good for your brains in any way, shape, or form. It says, did you know that the International Agency for Research on Cancer classified radio frequency fields, including those from cell phones, as a possible carcinogen in 2011. The dangers of cell phones, cell phone use gained a lot of mainstream credibility in 2011 when the World Health Organization admitted that cell phone radiation may cause cancer as well. The statement was based off of cumulative decisions made by a team of 31 scientists from 14 countries, and I will guarantee you not one of them was from the United States. After reviewing evidence that suggested this to be the case, This is pretty startling news, especially given the fact that a child's brain absorbs much more radiation than that of an adult. And that is absolutely true. And people giving their kids, 5-year-old kids, cell phones are completely, utterly ridiculous. It is also important to note that studies have been conducted showing no link between cell phones and cancer, but none of these or those on the opposing sides have been long-term, since cell phone usage is fairly recent, too recent to know of any potential harmful consequences. I know one of the experiments I saw is they had something to simulate a brain within a little thing of water and then had the cell phone up against the water to kind of simulate brain fluid and the skull. They had a separator, some sort of, I don't know, box that would simulate the skull, and 100% it was reaching the mass that would be simulating the brain. Another problem is addiction. In China, and I've seen this, they have addiction camps for internet-addicted children. In China, for example, teenagers have become hooked on electronic screens, whether it be with their phone, computer, or video games. Many young people are spending countless hours in front of a screen without bothering to eat or sleep, sometimes even withholding their urge to use the bathroom. And again, that's that dopamine addiction. According to a blog report published in the New York Times, many have come to view the real world as fake. And we've talked about that as well. This whole other agenda of blending and melding the real world versus the fantasy world to really inject us into this matrix. So when the day comes that the world has been destroyed by large corporations and there's nothing left for you to see, you'll be happy living in your happy little matrix world that you can make whatever you want it to be. You know, I think that that all started back in the days of reality television when, and actually with even beyond that, with like sitcom TV, we've looked at studies that they've had, how people's emotions and the brain chemicals react to watching reruns of some of your favorite shows. There is definitely an emotional and a physical response to watching pretend life. And you can see it in today's world, how people get so wrapped up in these TV shows and you know, what these characters are doing. And ignoring their friends and family. I mean, to me, it's just a disgusting thing. I do the least amount of television possible. In my 20 minutes of sitting down to eat, I catch some of the faux news that's out there to see what they're trying to pawn off onto the unsuspecting public. But, you know, despite maybe one or two science shows here and there, and every once in a while I'll try and catch something on YouTube, you know, besides the video clips that I share, and try to see what the agenda is, I don't do much at all of television anymore. Anyway, this viewing the real world as fake in China, this phenomenon is actually considered a clinical disorder. And as a result, a number of rehabilitation centers have been established where young people addicted to screens are completely isolated from all media. Yes, get them out into the trees and nature. They're going to go through some withdrawal. But I think eventually they will see how much happier the world looks when they realize that there's a real world out there. Although the success from these treatment centers is still unknown, it paints a dark picture of the technological age in which we live and does not seem to bode well for our future. Well, no, it doesn't, because you know what? Our future is going to be merging with the machine. That is where they've set it, and they are going toward that at light speed. Studies in China show that people who spend more than 6 hours on the internet for something other than work or study are likely to become addicted. And I'm going to tell you that even more than 6 hours for work makes me addicted, because I always got to know what's going on. Below is a trailer for the documentary called Web Junkies, shedding light on this troubling aspect of modern life. And maybe we can, let me just see, is there anything playing in the background? Maybe we can play this little clip here for a second. Let me see if I can find myself. I mean, I don't know about you, But like I've said many times, I have lived, eaten, and breathed technology for the last 25 plus years. I mean, go back to 1982 with the first computer. And the fact that I love science fiction has been even more than that, but for professionally 25 years, and I never, ever thought, I love that his, I never, ever thought I would see us where we are today. This is just so bothersome to me. And, you know, if I didn't have a child, it might be different. But when you look at the legacy that we are leaving for our children and the future that we're leaving for our children, where we won't be here to protect them from this eventually, I really am having a very huge, huge issue with this. And some days I wish the big EMP would just come and knock it all out so we had to start all over. All right, here we go. So this is a trailer from the documentary Web Junkies. China's Web Junkies. Oh, this might all be in Chinese. It's a boot camp, basically. Yeah, I don't know if this is going to work. Oh, well, you know what? You might want to find it on YouTube. I've seen clips, Pigmine had videos, actually, in regards to the addiction by these Chinese children. And they were in English, but this one embedded seems to be in Chinese with subtitles. Anyway, I want to finish with the rest of the story. It says, it's not just in China. This thing is seen all around the world. Quote, while internet addiction is not yet considered a clinical diagnosis here, there is no question that American youths are plugged in and tuned out of live action for many more hours a day than experts consider healthy for normal development. I mean, I remember too when my daughter was just a baby, they were selling baby TV and all this stuff, get your kid connected, all the learning. I mean, we've talked about how schools are using computers now to augment learning, and they're sitting the kids in front of a computer. And we read a story the other day about how looking stuff up versus discovering and doing old school type research causes you not to be able to retain facts anymore. And they were saying, wow, what a good thing getting rid of all these unnecessary facts that change out of your brain is great because it clears room for new information. No, it isn't. It allows revisionist history to be easily done without anyone questioning anything. Back to the story. It says, and it starts early, and this is plugging our kids in, often with pre-verbal toddlers handed their parents cell phones and tablets, and that's exactly it, to entertain themselves when they should be observing the world around them and interacting with their caregivers. As we continue to move forward, this type of addiction and behavior becomes even more disturbing. The power that some multinational corporations have alongside their clever marketing tactics, basically making whatever product or idea they choose to be desirable to the human mind, is worrisome. And that is true as well. I think I mentioned to you guys back during the school year, my daughter came home from school and told me that they had them on the computer doing some sort of math-based training. And at the end of this training came an ad from Google with their self-driving car that gave them this little promo video and then asked for their opinions and gave them a little box to type in what they thought. And my daughter typed in that no, she didn't think the Google self-driving car was a good idea. And then it asked her why. And she typed in because it could drive you to the police station. So much for mom. I'm lucky they didn't show up here, but it's true. Oh, I saw that self-driving car now is going to be launching in Austin, Texas. I posted that yesterday. So now it's in California as well as in Texas. Look out because it's coming. A few years ago, the Academy of Pediatrics found that the average 8 to 10-year-old spends almost 8 hours a day with different varieties of media. And older children as well as teenagers spend even more, upwards of 11 hours a day. Now, that is just unbelievable to me. 8 hours a day? My kid, if I am lucky and I push it, I maybe can keep it under an hour. And many times it's not even on the internet. I let her play with Photoshop and we've taught her to use that. And she's really good with creating graphics, which, hey, I mean, we should all know how to do. And Photoshop, of course, is the tool of choice. But 8 hours a day on the internet? That's insane. A study conducted by the Massachusetts Aggression Reduction Center, which includes over 20,000 children and teens between grades 3 and 12, concluded that approximately 20% of grade 3 children already own a cell phone. Yes, my daughter's told me that lots of her friends have cell phones. Why can't she have one? These numbers steadily rose from that point forward to approximately 25% in grade 4, 39% in grade 5, and 83% in middle school. And I would say, yes, the majority in middle school probably have one. Think about that for a second. Is this not disturbing? What happens here and why is this happening? Cell phones, computers, and tablets are slowly taking over our lives. And while the majority of us remain engaged with these technologies, our world continues to suffer in various ways. It is almost as if we are made not to care. And yes, this is exactly what I've been saying. As the corporations are sucking every last bit of life out of our environment, polluting and selling it all. And I have a really, really disturbing story that I found. There's actually two of them, one from 1999 in a lawsuit through NAFTA for the Canadian government over water, and one that's currently in process where Nestle is not only sucking water out of California, but they're also sucking it out of British Columbia and all the Pacific Northwest where we're having these major wildfires. How are we letting this happen? All right, last paragraph here. Apart from the 9-to-5 grind, and that's exactly how we all, you know, kind of make ourselves feel better that we let it happen while we weren't paying attention because we were working. But remember, getting a paycheck is also a dangling carrot. It's the dangling carrots that get us to not pay attention to what we should be paying attention to. We are occupied by our electronics, our sports, our entertainment, and more, and we have become a species that has neglected our home. Humans need the earth, but the earth does not need humans. If I were the earth, I'd be saying, get off the ship, man. You lost your privileges. You've become a cancer to this planet, and that is very sad to me. We are another organism that should be living in symbiosis with the planet. You know, we are a red corpuscle of a larger organism, and the red corpuscle apparently has cancer. Thankfully, more and more people are starting to wake up. More people are starting to care, and this has led to a positive impact, but we have a long way to go, and concerns like the ones presented in this article are one of many we need to consider. And, I mean, here again, I'm going to go back to the dopamine. The way that we are losing this game is that it has caused a physical addiction in human beings that is so strong that it's really difficult to kick. And I just can't wait till the day when it's all gone to see these people start flipping the fuck out because they don't have their devices. I mean, I know when my internet's out here, it's hard. I mean, I worry because the network's offline. But when we go down and it's been 4, 5, 6 hours, if I don't have TV or internet, I don't have, not that I watch them a lot, but I like to flip something on to see what's happening. When I'm disconnected, it definitely takes me a day or two to be able to readjust myself to not caring and to just going with the flow and living life as it comes, you know? All right, here's a story really quick, and then we're going to hop over to some of the DARPA stuff. This is talking about not caring and how did this happen. This was out of CBC News Canada from October 22nd, 1999, titled U.S. Firm Sues Canada for $10.5 billion over water. This was in 1999 that this came out. An American, so we go, oh, well, you know, Nestle, blah, blah, blah. Well, get this, it's happening for much longer than we thought. An American-owned water export company has launched a massive lawsuit against Canada for preventing it from exporting fresh water from British Columbia. And remember, people, with this TPP, Tippy and Pippy and Sopa, Popa, Topa, I don't know, all these freaking international trade agreements where they're going to allow corporations to sue you if they think that they're being harmed or damaged by your laws. You know, that already happened under NAFTA and the World Trade Organization. We looked at two with the WTO back a few weeks ago, where Japan is suing for countries that don't want to accept its radioactive seafood. We also have Mexico and Canada suing the U.S. for not labeling, or for labeling, country of origin labels on meats. And lo and behold, they just got rid of that now in the Congress. We don't need to know what country our meats come from anymore, because it doesn't matter. People didn't want to buy foreign meat. Well, put on a seatbelt, like I said, because this is going to come right in our faces, and it's going to happen before we know it. But it was already happening in the 90s. Sunbelt Water Company of California is suing Canada, and this was 1999, for $10.5 billion, the Canadian Foreign Ministry said October 22nd, 1999. The suit has been filed under Chapter 11 of the North American Free Trade Agreement. Ding, da, da, ding. Sunbelt said it has been mistreated by the British Columbian government. The clash over exporting water goes all the way back to 1993, when Sunbelt and Snowcap Waters Limited, a Canadian partner, sued the British Columbian government for banning bulk water exports to California. Snowcap Waters agreed to a settlement of $335,000 Canadian. Sunbelt did not settle with the province, and the company says that British Columbia banning water exports from the province violates terms and conditions of NAFTA. Look at it. This is carbon copy TPP. The lawsuit has upset environmentalists, who are angry that companies wanting to make money off of exporting water are using NAFTA to override environmental laws. Well, TPP all the way. Ottawa has 90 days to examine the Sunbelt lawsuit. In a related development, at a hearing Thursday night in Montreal, groups concerned about exports of bulk water demanded the International Joint Commission, the IJC, include the recommendation when it reports to Ottawa and Washington early in the new year. The IJC is the group appointed by the Canadian and the U.S. governments to manage the country's shared water. Well, that's an organization we should definitely dig into, because I will guarantee you that by now they're bought and sold. The problem with NAFTA's Chapter 11 is that it allows water to be regarded simply as a good or product that can be sold or traded between countries. And if a country stops its export, the company proposing the commercial use could sue for compensation. Well, looks like they did, because, and it looks like they sold us down the river, because now in 2015, we have a news story. Let me open this up. Nestle now faces renewed criticism of their British Columbia groundwater operations as drought levels increase. So that was 1999. Fast forward to July 9, 2015, which is today. Still the same place. British Columbia says as fires rage and drought levels increase throughout the province, one company is facing a new round of attacks for the amount of groundwater they take from British Columbia. Nestle Waters takes approximately 230 million liters of fresh water every year from an aquifer in the Fraser Valley. They now pay $2.25 for every million liters. $2.25. You heard that right. For every million liters of water. And that in and of itself is new, because as Nestle was previously able to take the water for free before the new legislation brought in last year. So Nestle's been taking this water for free, 230 million liters of water for free, bottling it up and selling it for $5 or $6 a case. And now they pay $2.25 for every million liters coming out of drought-stricken areas. The petition, a petition launched earlier this year demanding the province charge a fair price for groundwater, has gained renewed attention in the last week and now has over 160,000 signatures. Only 160,000 signatures, I should say. 160,000 Canadians is enough to show it's an issue we really care about, says Liz McDowell, a spokesperson with the group Some of You, which launched the petition. We don't want to be looking 20 years in the future and saying we really wish we could have gotten taken better action. I think the current drought and the wildfires across the province are a real wake-up call. You think? It should be. You know what, guys? This commercialization of freaking water and sucking it out of the ground for nothing or next to nothing and selling it and making a profit off of it, as we have farms that can't water food, we have animals being culled because we can't give them water, we have fines, you can't wash or shower or do any of these things because we have this massive, historic, never-before-seen, worst-ever drought going on, and they're letting these fracking companies pollute all the groundwater and these multinational corporations suck it out of the ground for a song and sell it to whoever's the highest bidder. This is bullshit. While Nestle wouldn't agree to an on-camera interview, Global News is strongly defending its water use records in British Columbia, saying its actions aren't negatively affecting the province during this drought. Of course they're not. Rivers, lakes, and streams are primarily affected by the drought, and Nestle Waters Canada does not draw waters from the rivers, lakes, and streams. Well, duh. The water that's in rivers, lakes, and streams still comes from rain. The water that's in groundwater still eventually works its way down into the groundwater from rain and snow. So, okay, yeah, broken science logic there. It draws its water from a groundwater aquifer deep below the Earth's surface. And yes, that water just magically appeared there, wrote John Chalinor, Director of Corporate Affairs for Nestle Water Canada, in an email. For all the Canadian listeners we have, you guys need to get on the ball and go after these assholes. I'll drop this link in the chat when I'm done. We are strongly committed to responsible water management and continually monitor our groundwater withdrawal levels and associated water resource indicators, such as aquifer levels, spring flows, and surface water levels, to ensure no adverse effects to the watershed, the associated ecosystem, our neighbors, and other water users. Did we not just see a study a week ago from NASA saying that the Earth is running out of water? I believe we did. Well, if that's the case, then all of this commercialization should be stopped immediately. They say we withdraw less than 1% of the available groundwater in Kawaka Lake subwatershed, and each year we publicly report our withdrawals and monitor data in an annual hydrologic monitoring report. And these reports conclude that Nestle Water Canada has no negative impact on the Kawaka Lake subwatershed in our 15-year history of our operations. So absolutely no negative impact whatsoever. Yes, well paid off for those reports. Their response is unlikely to quell the anger of many people in this province who are reducing their water use. Exactly. But Nestle, which pointed out to Global News, there were at least a dozen other water bottling companies operating in British Columbia, says that it is fully complying with provincial law and they are being a good corporate citizen. The District of Hope, where our business is located, last week decided to restrict water use across the community by no longer allowing residents or businesses to undertake outdoor watering activities, watering lawns, or watering playing fields, parks, or public open spaces. And of course, then, Here's a video how British Columbia drought has impacted food prices, and we know that that is just a side effect, and in the end, it is going to affect every single one of us. No water, no food, no food, no life, no water, no life. It's great, but these multinational corporations are complying with the law, so we should be happy and just shut the fuck up. It's unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. And don't worry about it, because Farmville on your Facebook or Google game app, Farmville's got plenty of water, people. So don't worry about it, because it's not really happening in the Matrix. How unbelievable is that? Let's see how much stupider we could become. There was a story that came out the other day about how eating sugar can make you stupid. So not only does it make you addicted, it makes you stupid as well. And I think that that is quite evident by all of what is going on here, that nobody stands up, or the very small majority of people stand up and say anything at all, because, hey, Nestle's in our best interest, right? Nestle makes things that we know and love since we were kids, right? They make chocolate, right? Hot chocolate. Nestle Quick, right? Yeah, that's exactly it. All right. So what are we going to look at now? Well, let's look at this whole push toward transhumanism and what a great idea it is. We've talked about Surrey. I've mentioned it a couple times, how, you know, Apple keeps saying that they're not allowing anyone to spy on you, et cetera, et cetera. And then we watch an interview with the director of DARPA, who fully freely admits that Surrey, who's your first generation personal digital assistant that eventually is going to be your cognitive reality implanted in your brain. How Surrey is your first generation personal assistant. It was created by DARPA. Well, listen to this. It is the age of smart devices, from Apple's Surrey to Amazon's Echo. Helpful personal assistants are being built into the world around us. And why? Well, because remember the study, the more you use the internet to find information that doesn't matter, it changes frequently, we don't remember it. And don't worry about it, because our personal digital assistants are making us stupider. Well, while we are still waiting for Surrey to get a little better, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, more affectionately known as DARPA, wants to go a step further. They want to build personal digital assistant machines that can anticipate your every need by what? Reading your mind and your body signals. Yes, you heard that right. In a talk at June's DARPA Biology Technology Conference in New York City, that's that BTO division they created, DARPA's program manager, Justin Sanchez, explained that the data from our smartwatches and trackers, and we talked about those as well, Google is well invested in that, where they can track your every move and all your biorhythms, that your smartwatches and trackers actually end up being pretty meaningless, since these devices cannot put data in any sort of context or output that recommends an action in response. Many of you are just getting things back, like this is what your heart rate is just now, or you took 6,000 steps a day, he said during a talk. Yeah, but don't think that that isn't conditioning you. It is absolutely conditioning you. My dad has an iPhone, and he's got his little step tracker on and his GPS. They're following him, and they're tracking everything he does all day. But this dude says, hey, who cares about that stuff? What you really want to do is use that information to help you interact with machines in a much deeper way. Today, we don't typically aggregate those signals together and do something with it, but they will once it goes into the database. And they have the what ding ding algorithm. With the proliferation of these sensors and smartwatches and trackers, Sanchez says it is the right time to develop a smart device that can read these mind and body signals, connect to an external device that makes sense of this information, and then use that information to anticipate what you need and make recommendations. Can anyone say Jibo? We have all the pieces, Sanchez told Business Insider, and these sensors are starting to be everywhere. They are not only in our environment, they're also in our bodies. We've got the computing. They are also in our bodies, he says. I'd like to know where. We've got the computing power to take the information of these sensors, and we've got the mobile platforms. So we have that interface at every step of our everyday lives. For Sanchez, the possibilities of this technology would be endless. He points to the Nest Learning Thermostat. I was just looking at those, which can make changes to the temperature throughout the day based on your past settings. As an example, the Nest Thermostat puts machine learning to practical use, ensuring that after a few days, you may never have to set the thermostat again. Machine learning is a subfield of AI, artificial intelligence science, focused on taking your past patterns and making predictions based upon those patterns. Don't forget, too, future crime, this whole mind crime, brain, what do they call it? Precognition. Sanchez imagines a quote-unquote physiological computer that can read body and mind signals like heart rate and temperature and be able to tell if you're hot, cold, sleepy, frightened, or bored. And remember, we had looked at a clip back months ago already with that new Intel chip, and I don't remember what it was called, but the chick had those spider robots with the Intel chip on her dress that reacted to her biorhythms and whether or not she became anxious. And if she did, it went into a defensive posture where it put out these scary looking spiky legs to keep danger away from her. It says you could interact with your environment and your architecture. Let's say that you are having a low point in your day in terms of productivity. So what if you had an interface that could say, how about doing this? Yes, or give you an electroshock. Maybe this would spark your productivity. Sanchez's talk was called Brain Machine Symbiosis. Oh my God, didn't we just say that we had a symbiosis with planet Earth? Well, guess what? Here we go, next level, Brain Machine Symbiosis, and suggested that the seamless communication could one day happen directly between our brains and the devices through the use of what? Yes, implantable sensors. And I'm going to run out of time, but there was a video that came out of RT that also talked about this. It says, DARPA plotting to remote control fear and your nervous system. Let's see if I can play this quick before I hit the bell. We're going to fast forward just slightly until we get past her music that I still don't like. Here we go.
Agencies within the government. But to me, the one that takes the cake is DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. They're the craziest agency because, man, do they dream up some futuristic, insane stuff. And they just did it again at their Biology is Technology conference. How's that for scary sounding? DARPA put the conference on so that they could talk to third-party biotechnology labs about scientific ideas they'd like to fund. And one of those ideas really stood out. Apparently, DARPA is interested in the ability to control human fear and anxiety. They want to create advanced bioelectric medicines or tools that can directly communicate with and deliver information right into people's nervous systems. Those tools would allow the military to control its soldiers' bodies. They'd be able to lower blood pressure and control adrenal responses happening right inside of soldiers' bodies. So that when soldiers are in battle, back at the base, personnel could control what's going on inside the soldiers' bodies. So, if a soldier was engaged in battle and got scared or anxious, the military could simply adjust that soldier's adrenal levels or blood pressure or other biological functioning so that the soldier would no longer feel the paralyzing effects of fear and anxiety.
Now, one thing I want to... Hold on, I hope I'm not muted. Oh, I'm not. Okay. One thing I want to point out, too, you know, we've been looking at all these brain chemicals and how they can affect us. If they had the ability to physically turn this on and off and control our ability to feel fear or anxiety or whatever, think about the frightening implications of this. DARPA needs to be freaking taken out fast.
thus making them a better killing machine. The craziest part is that they're actually pretty close to creating technology to raise or lower blood pressure with the turn of a remote dial. Now, these kinds of biotech advances could have nice-sounding applications, too. For instance, a ridiculously high number of our soldiers end up with PTSD. These biotechnologies could end up helping those soldiers instead of them having to take lots of medications. And of course, the technologies could have great use for people outside of the military, other people who suffer from anxiety. And that sounds great. I don't want anyone to have anxiety, whether it's because they bought into the military's crap or just regular civilian crap. But here's the thing. There's a reason we feel fear and anxiety. It's because something's wrong, emotionally, physically, or psychologically.
Yes, and remember, it's the survival instinct. We talked about that. So let's just get rid of it all. It's going to be over, people.
Medicating those feelings is one way to not really deal with those problems. Remote controlling them is just another. If the military really wants to help people feel less anxious, they should just stop with all their warring in the first place. But that's America for you. We treat the symptom, never the real problem.
And there you go. I mean, talk about absolute insanity. And she even mentioned, like, the drugs. You know, we were talking about the drugs and satiating, making you feel better when you're depressed or sad because, you know, your boyfriend broke up with you or your cat died. But you know what? All you need is nature, people. And as we move further and further down this path of merging with machine, and what did he call it? A symbiosis? I mean, this is exactly it. As they suck us away and take full control over all your biology, it's over. Human 2.0 is going to be an absolute 100 slave to the machine. Very last thing here, it says Sanchez's talk was called Brain Machine Symbiosis, and he suggested that the seamless communication could one day happen directly between the brain and our devices through the use of implantable sensors, but implants cannot detect the brain's electrical signals, and they still have to go a long way. For one thing, scientists still have to design devices that can stay in the brain for a long time without causing damage or losing functionality. Surgery to place implants is invasive, and surgeons drill small holes through the skull to insert long, thin electrodes inside of the brain. And remember, we looked at that with the remote-controlled moths as well and the cockroaches, so that's already being worked on. All right, guys, if you could believe it, it is already over. We got about 10 seconds. It's Thursday, so make sure you stick around. We have Lonnie Clark up next, and I think she has Mr. Kevin Blanche calling in. For Post Ignorance at 6 p.m. Eastern, we have Webster Tarpley's show is going to be on 6 to 8. Behind the Woodshed with Hale Anthony at 8. Double Crossed with Chuck at 10 p.m. Eastern. And Anti-Media Radio with S.M. Gibson at 11. All right, guys, everyone try to have an awesome Thursday. And I will catch up with you tomorrow. Everybody.